Boy, a lot of medical stuff today.
Yeah, really.
I had my physical this week, and it all came back pretty good. The doctor said I needed to reduce my sodium intake. I took his advice with a grain of salt.
SLJ used to complain about that when he got his.
Yeah. No, he didn't say that. I did okay.
He was salty about his recommendations.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got a lot to cover today. Our text is going to be the 31st chapter of Genesis, and we have 55 verses in this chapter, so it's a long chapter. This is our 45th lesson, the book of Genesis, and I've titled today's lesson, The Grand Bargain. As an opening scripture, I want to look back to some verses we covered recently back in the 28th chapter of the book of Genesis, and I'm going to read verses 12 through 15 just as a little bit of background, because I want to look at the promises that God made to Jacob when he was at Bethel, when he fled from Esau, because they're going to be pertinent to today's lesson as Jacob now flees from his uncle Laban. So beginning with Genesis 28:12, Jacob had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your descendants. Your descendants also will be like the dust of the earth, and you'll spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I'm with you, and I'll keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I've done all that I promised to you. Genesis chapter 31, the chapter we're looking at today, is a long chapter, and it can actually be divided into four sections, and you can see those in the first page of your handout. Section number one is Jacob's decision to flee from Laban. That'll cover the first 21st verses of the chapter. Laban's pursuit of Jacob, of course, and his accusation of deception, verses 22 through 35. Section three is Jacob's rebuttal of Laban in verses 36 to 42, and then the covenant of Mizpah, the final separation in verses 43 through 55. If we are looking for the object lessons, the takeaways from the chapter really are two in terms of big picture things. One is the obedience of Jacob under duress and the protection of Jacob under the divine promises which were made to him by God at Bethel. So let's begin with section one, Jacob's decision to flee from Laban. And I'm going to flip over to the 31st chapter of Genesis and read the first 21 verses. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what belonged to our father, he has made his wealth. Jacob saw the attitude of Laban. It literally says the face of Laban, but it's his countenance. He saw the attitude of Laban, and behold, it was not friendly toward him as formerly. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I'll be with you. So Jacob sent, and he called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field, said to them, I see your father's attitude, that it's not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I've served your father with all my strength, yet your father has cheated me. He's changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. If he spoke thus, the speckled shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth speckled. And if he spoke thus, the striped shall be your wages, then the flock brought forth striped. This is an important verse. Thus, God has taken away your father's livestock, and giving them to me. And it came about at the time when the flocks were mating that I lifted up my eyes and I saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Mottled simply means spotted. Then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob, and I said, here am I. He said, lift up now your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and spotted. For I've seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I'm the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Now arise and leave this land and return to the land of your birth. Rachel and Leah said to him, do we still have any portion or inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he has sold us out, and he's also entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. Then Jacob arose, and he put his children and his wives upon camels, and he drove away with all his livestock and his property that he had gathered, and his livestock which he had gathered in Paddan Aram. Paddan Aram is simply Syria, so I'll be referring to that as Syria. Paddan Aram, leave Syria, go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to shear his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols, which were her father's. And Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, the Syrian, by not telling him that he was fleeing. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the Euphrates River and set his face toward the hill country of Gilead. This closes out a chapter in Jacob's life that began 20 years ago. So 20 years has passed since we began to see Jacob in the household of Laban. This is when he fled from Esau, and he took up residence with Laban in Haran, a city in Syria. His years with Laban were not pleasant. They were filled with deception, strife, dissension. Jacob's life in Syria was constantly in conflict. During the first 14 years of his time with Laban, Jacob served him for his two daughters, Leah and Rachel, the girls who became his wives. But during the last 6 years, the central issue has become the acquisition of assets, or perhaps more accurately, the transfer of assets from Laban to Jacob. And I think this was related to the blessing promise of the Abrahamic covenant. This is why this is taking place. So Laban and his sons watched Jacob's assets increase while their assets decreased, and this did not set well with them. From their point of view, Jacob became rich at the expense of Laban and his family. And in fact, as they considered this, this is exactly what's happening. Jacob is becoming wealthy and Laban is becoming poor. So for some time, Jacob must have been thinking about going home from Syria, going back to Canaan. He was aware of this growing tension between himself and Laban and Laban's sons, and it was a situation that was potentially going to evolve into violence. From the son's point of view, Jacob was stealing their inheritance. And greed, as we know, will distort a person's perception of moral reality, by which I mean the ability to distinguish right and wrong. For only a distorted view of reality could conclude that Jacob had stolen anything from Laban. In fact, just the opposite was true. Jacob had made Laban wealthy. For an example of what the Bible calls envy, if you're interested, just think about verse 1. Laban's sons resented Jacob's gain, and Jacob's wealth increased, their desire to possess it for themselves increased. Laban's sons had learned this from their father Laban. Having Jacob around was not a problem. It wasn't difficult when Jacob was poor and Laban was rich, but the tables have turned. And the relative positions of these two men is being reversed. And this took a toll on Laban, and it happened because God had a plan. God's plan was to increase Jacob's wealth at the expense of Laban's, and this did not set well with Laban and his sons. Laban's change of attitude toward Jacob is the result of a change in his circumstances. This is human nature. Human beings, I hate to say this, but we are naturally self-centered and selfish. It's what we are. And it's not uncommon for jealousy to develop when someone who formerly had less becomes rich at the very time the formerly wealthy individual's assets are dwindling. This is what I'm alluding to when I say having Jacob around was not difficult when Jacob was poor and Laban was rich. But God reversed their circumstances by giving Laban's wealth to Jacob, and this became a big problem for Laban. Since I can remember, I've had this idea in the back of my mind that one day I would probably end up homeless. I don't know why. It just seems like something that would happen to me. I know myself well. And Linda and I have laughed about this little obsession of mine, considering that if it happens, we got pretty good at being poor when we were first married. And guess what? We were happy. We were happy. So I'm pretty sure if we had to do it again, we could do that because we know how to do that. As our lives, you know, we went through the years, we used to reminisce with my friend Greg, whose memorial service I officiated recently up in Ohio in July. He and his wife Karen and Linda and I started out our married life without much of anything. And we enjoyed swapping stories with them about those early days because, well, we had a lot in common. Greg used to tell the story that the only transportation that he and Karen had when they got married was a Harley Davidson Sportster. And it didn't have a back seat, and they couldn't afford to buy one. So for about a year, Karen rode on the back fender of that motorcycle on a dish towel. You know, you wouldn't want to scratch the paint. A reversal of fortune would be hard to take, and I don't think anyone really wants to experience one, and it probably would be worse if you had always been well off, and I think Laban was. So this reversal of fortune really took a toll on Laban and his family, on his sons because they saw their inheritance diminishing, and on Laban because Jacob no longer was easily manipulated. In fact, Jacob was becoming more powerful than Laban. God altered the circumstances of these two men in order to bring Jacob into the next phase of his life, for the time had come for God to fulfill the promises that he had made to Jacob back in verses 11 through 13. God is bringing Jacob home again to Canaan. This return to Canaan was initiated by God as a command. It was a command he gave to Jacob. God appeared to him in a dream, and he commanded him to leave Syria and go back to Canaan. God works in our lives providentially to bring about the changes that he desires. This is stated clearly in verse 9, where we read, "Thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me." The change in Jacob's circumstances was accompanied by a divine command to return to Canaan, indicating that God dealt with Jacob both providentially and through his revealed word. As we've seen before in Genesis, divine commands often are preceded by divine promises. And in this case, the promises given at Bethel are, "I will be with you, I will not leave you, and behold, I am with you, I will protect you, and I will bring you back to the land of Canaan, to the promised land." Well, verse 3 is a summary statement. The details to the summary statement will follow later in the chapter. Likely, Jacob had considered leaving for a long time, especially over the past 6 years. I think over time, God had put into Jacob's mind the plan by which he would acquire a large portion of Laban's assets. And the idea came to him in a divinely inspired dream, or perhaps a series of dreams. In fact, when Jacob spoke with his wives, he may have conflated more than one dream, a dream certainly that he had 6 years earlier when he got the idea that formed the basis for the deal that he made with Laban in verses 31 to 33, specifically the roles of the striped, speckled, and spotted goats. And Jeff clearly explained all that last week. And a more recent dream are dreams telling him to leave immediately for the land of Canaan. Whatever the sequence of events may have been, leaving Canaan with his wife and children and his possessions, composed primarily of animals, quite frankly, was a considerable overtaking. It's about a 450 to 500 mile trek from Syria, where he was living, back to the home where Isaac was living. And so he must have been thinking about the logistics of this move for some time. For example, he would need to consider the opposition that he's going to receive from Laban. Leaving with most of the animals that formerly belonged to Laban would not be met with good cheer from his uncle. He'd also want to consider the timing. For example, leaving when Laban and his sons were sharing their flocks might give him a head start. He also would want to consider the departure point prior to leaving. He would want to move his flocks to pastures that were located in the direction that he would be traveling, which would be south-southwest, and he would position them as far away from Laban's shearing operation as possible. And the last thing he would want to do is talk to Leah and Rachel. Rachel couldn't afford a leak. He could not afford for word to get back to Laban that he was considering leaving. But despite the difficulties, the directive to return to Canaan is really good news. It's good news because this is going to put to rest 20 years of misery working for Laban as a virtual slave. But getting away with the better part of Laban's assets, which now rightfully belong to Jacob, would not be easy. Laban was certain to pursue him with a vengeance. Verses 4 through 13 contain the first great speech in the chapter. It's the speech where Jacob addresses his wives. The conversation is conducted in secret because Jacob doesn't know how they're going to react. Will they object to leaving their father? Jacob doesn't know, and he couldn't afford some sort of a scene that would tip off Laban. But beyond this, we see the beginning of a theme that carries on through the rest of the chapter. And that theme is the final separation of the Syrians and the Hebrews. His speech begins in verse 5 with an objective statement, an observation about which he knows Leah and Rachel will probably agree. He says, "Your father's demeanor is not friendly as it was before. Laban is a slave to his circumstances. They rule him rather than the other way around. Laban's attitude has changed because his situation has changed. His circumstances have been altered providentially by God." So here we enter a section of the text where we begin to see contrast. And these contrasts clearly support the contention that the providence of God is at work in the destinies of these two families. Jacob points out to his wives, "Your father's face is against me." But in contrast to that, he says, "But my God, my father, has been with me. God has overruled the former circumstances." Then in verses 6 and 7, Jacob provides for his wives objective evidence for his claims. He says, "I've served your father with all my strength, but your father has cheated me again and again. And yet, in spite of this, God has restrained him from hurting me." Whatever Laban did to cheat Jacob, God brought it to naught, because God alters circumstances for the benefits of his chosen people. Despite Jacob's hard work, he reminds his wives that Laban changed his compensation plan, if you want to think of it that way. He changed his wages 10 times, and they knew this to be true. By the way, 10 times is just a handy way of saying over and over. Whenever it was convenient for Laban to do so, he took advantage of Jacob. In verses 8 and 9, we learn that Laban changed the rules constantly. Originally, Jacob was to receive as his wages all the sheep and goats based on certain color and marking patterns. If Laban said the speckled animals that are, he's speaking here of animals that will be born, he says, "If the speckled animals shall be your wages, the flock more speckled." But if he changed his mind and said, "No, the striped animals shall be your wages, the flock more striped." The explanation for this is given in verse 9. Thus God snatched away the animals of your father, and he gave them to me. So now we know how Laban changed Jacob's wages over the years. He nitpicked about the color patterns of these animals. And yet at every turn, God frustrated his efforts by blessing Jacob in spite of Laban. Now this must have become somewhat humorous after a while, at least to Jacob, for he surely saw in this the poetic justice of the hand of God at work. When Laban switched Leah for Rachel, he thought he had made a ruse of naive Jacob. And he did the same thing over the years with the terms of his contract with Jacob. But God continually frustrated his efforts by not allowing Laban to harm Jacob in any substantial way. As you see, what's really happening here is Laban's fighting not Jacob, he's fighting God. And when a man fights God, he loses. What God did was just. He switched the assets. God remained just in doing this because Laban's assets really were God's assets all along, and he can do with them whatever he chooses. In verses 10 and 13, we get to see a little bit of the plan that's devised. Notice in verse 13, God identifies himself as the God of Bethel. This little phrase causes Jacob to recall the dream that he had 20 years earlier at the beginning of his trip to Syria as he lay asleep on the ground in Bethel. And he would remember the promises God made to him at that time. I'll be with you, I'll protect you, and I will bring you back to this land. Well, 20 years have passed, and a lot has happened to clutter the mind of Jacob. But during this time, God hasn't changed. God is immutable, and he expects Jacob to set aside the past and step forward into a future that includes all the things God promised him 20 years before. The identification of Yahweh as the God of Bethel also reminds Jacob of a vow that he made. He made that vow to God when he was at Bethel. In verses 14 through 16, Rachel and Leah both consent to go to Canaan with Jacob. But the women weren't there at Bethel. Think about this. They didn't have the experience with the Lord that Jacob had that night at Bethel. So they can't possibly share the depth of Jacob's spiritual connection to that place. Rachel and Leah are concerned about material things. They're focused on Laban's mistreatment of them, and in particular, his squandering of their inheritance. Verse 15 sums up their feelings. Laban treats us like strangers, and he's sold us out. Well, the departure occurs in verses 17 to 21. It must have been with some sense of fear and relief that Jacob put his family on the camels and left Laban's school of hard knocks for home. What's that? I always have to stop and make sure it's not something just going on in my head. Which it could be, you know.
But it sounds like a Harley.
Yeah.
We heard it too.
I had six Harleys, so I've ruined my ears over the years. Okay, where am I? All right. So we've got this switch of fortune. We've got Laban's assets going to Jacob. And I always enjoyed watching Michael Irvin play football for the Dallas Cowboys. He was a character. It may have been about 25 years ago. I can't remember exactly when this was, but it was when Dale Hansen was still doing sports on WFAA. I stopped watching WFA for a while until Dale Hansen stopped doing sports on WFAA, and now I watch it again. But I'll have to paraphrase this because I don't have a transcript of the interview, but he interviewed Michael Irvin, and Michael was answering a question about his battle with cocaine addiction. And this was interesting to me. With tears in his eyes, Michael Irvin said something I'll never forget. He said, "It wasn't during the down times that I turned to this drug. It was during the good times when I was on top of the world. The bad times always came later." Jacob knew both the bad times and the good times. He wasn't perfect, but he was a man who, for the most part, was faithful. He served Laban faithfully while he was being cheated, and he stayed true to his commitments when things were going well with him. And I think we should keep this in mind, for as Michael Irvin implied, success can be a harder test than failure. Spiritual maturity doesn't always come as quickly as we'd like. It's taken 20 years for God to mold Jacob into the man that he now is, and now's the time for Jacob to go home. Sometimes the greatest impediment to spiritual growth is Satan's ability to use our failures and or our successes against us. And by the way, this process of progressive sanctification never ends. In some ways, Jacob's biggest tests are still ahead of him. It's not going to be long before he buries the love of his life, Rachel, near Bethlehem. He'll endure for years what he believes was the loss of the first son Rachel bore to him, Joseph. He'll endure famine. He'll endure the stress that goes with being responsible for a large family and a business with insufficient resources. And for a second time in his life, Jacob will live as an alien in a foreign land. The next time it'll be Egypt. The great men of the Bible typically did not arrive on the scene spiritually mature and fully at rest in God's grace, because spiritual maturity, spiritual growth, is a journey. And along the way, there are tests, and there are going to be disappointments, and there's going to be sickness, and there's going to be loss. Well, this brings us to section 2 of the chapter, Laban's pursuit of Jacob and his accusation of deception. So let's begin reading with verse 22. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. Gilead is east of the Jordan River. It's also something we sometimes refer to as Transjordan. God came to Laban the Syrian in a dream of the night, and he said to him, "Be careful that you don't speak either good or bad to Jacob." Laban caught up with Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the hill country, and Laban with his kinsmen camped in the hill country of Gilead. Then Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and songs and timbrel and lyre and you didn't even allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now that you've done this foolishly. It's in my power to do harm to you, but the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, 'Be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob.' Now, you've indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" Then Jacob replied to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I thought that you would not take your daughters from me, that you might take your daughters from me by force. The one with whom you find your gods shall not live in the presence of our kinsmen. Point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself." For Jacob did not know Rachel had stolen them. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maids, and he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in a camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt through all the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me." So he searched, but he did not find the household idols. This is a turning point in the Jacob narratives. From this point forward, Jacob and Laban will be adversaries. There have been prior conflicts, but up to this time in this confrontation, Jacob had considered Laban to be family. That tie is now broken. In verses 20 and also in verse 24, Laban no longer is referred to as his mother's brother. Now he is Laban the Syrian. Beyond the physical departure of Jacob with his family and possessions, this is a second indication of a permanent division between the clans of Laban and Jacob. No longer will the sons of Israel go to Syria for their wives. Now there's a permanent schism here that's developing, that's separating Israel from Syria, that's based on divine election. Verses 23 to 25 cover Laban's pursuit of Jacob and his accusations against him. 3 days passed before Laban learned Jacob had departed, and he came after Jacob with a vengeance that was driven by greed. After a 7-day chase, Laban caught Jacob in the hill country of Gilead, and he encamped opposite the camp of Jacob. Verse 24 records a dream God had sent to Laban that night in order to protect Jacob. Before he was able to exact any harm, God warned Laban not to speak to Jacob, either good or bad. This phrase, good or bad, is a figure of speech called a merism. A merism. Let me tell you what a merism is. It's a figure of speech that expresses the full range of possibilities and everything in between. So when we read in the first verse of Genesis, God created the heavens and the earth. Heavens and the earth is a merism. It means that God created the heavens, he created the earth, and he created everything else as well. Alpha and Omega is a merism. The first and the last is a merism. Not to speak to Jacob, either good or bad, means don't do anything in an attempt to change this situation. Jacob is not going back to Syria with you, period. Now, there are two things that we learn at this point. It's clear God has put a protective hedge around Jacob, and Laban can't bridge this hedge. Even though Laban says in verse 29, I have the power to hurt you. I think on a human level, that was true. But, and this is the second thing we learn from the dream, God restrains Laban from doing so. It's reasonable to conclude, if not for the dream, Laban had every intention of overtaking Jacob and either persuading him to return to Syria under conditions that were favorable to Laban, or I think possibly killing him and reacquiring possession of his daughters and the flocks. So there's a lesson here about how God works guarding and protecting his people. Jacob was aware of the danger Laban posed. He could see the campfires in the distance. Jacob knew the morning would bring a confrontation that potentially was dangerous. He knew he was in peril. What Jacob did not know is God already had protected him from Laban, for Jacob didn't know anything about the dream. He should have known, however, that God had promised multiple times to protect him, but he didn't know how this divine protection would be exacted. And as we all know, promises can seem a bit abstract, especially when the enemy campfire burning across the battlefield is all too real. So Jacob also knew Laban, and he knew something about his personality, knew the man, and he knew that unrestrained, Laban would stop at nothing to take back what he unjustly believed still belonged to him. So here's the lesson. We don't always see what God's doing behind the scenes. It's not hard to see the danger. It's not hard to see the risk. Dangers and risk are quite evident. We see risks, and we see in our own lives potential loss of life, of health, of property. But we can be woefully blind to the sovereign power of God that surrounds us. Jacob knew he was in trouble. He was in a position that required him to trust in God's protection. But God had not yet revealed to him the plan that was unfolding providentially. There's a very interesting story in 2 Kings chapter 6 that illustrates what it means to be under God's sovereign protection. The story in 2 Kings involves the sons of the prophets who were under the tutelage of Elisha. Story begins when one of Elisha's attendants awoke to find they were surrounded by the army of Ben-Hadad, the king of the Arameans. And I think it's interesting, since we're studying about Laban here, that Ben-Hadad is a Syrian. So it's the Syrians here who are posing a threat against the people of God. Prophets typically are not warriors. And they were frightened by this overwhelming power of the Syrian army that was surrounding them. So listen to verse 15 of 2 Kings chapter 6. Now when the attendant of the man of God is Elisha, had risen early and gone out, behold the army, an army with horses and chariots. By the way, in this time and place, a chariot is the equivalent of an F-16. This is a serious war machine. So he looks out and he sees an army with horses and chariots circling the city. And his servant said to Elisha, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" These verses express the fear felt by this man as he awoke to find himself confronted by a very strong enemy. It parallels the way Jacob must have felt about Laban, who was camped nearby. Elisha's attendant asked, "What shall we do?" This is a normal response to a fearful situation, and Jacob must have asked himself the same question. Verses 16 and 17 provide the answer. So Elisha answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw, and behold, the mountains were full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. If you're a believer, every moment of your life, God is at work in ways you do not see or understand. His providence is not always visible to us. It's not always observable, just as these angels and the chariots of fire were not immediately visible to Elisha's attendant. Providence works behind the scenes in ways that are not always apparent until one day we look back and our eyes are opened and we see God's hand was at work all along. Trials, tests, sorrow, difficulties, loss, sickness, and danger are put in perspective when our eyes are opened and we see we were never alone. God was always there, always working out his plan, even in the midst of our fear and difficulties. This is the principle at work behind the scenes in Romans 8:28, specifically in the phrase, "God causes." Verse 25 prepares us for the actual meeting between Jacob and Laban. Then verses 26 through 30 record that meeting and Laban's accusations against Jacob. Laban came to Jacob's camp, but he didn't bring his army with him. He came by himself, armed only with indignation, hypocrisy, and self-righteousness. Laban's complaint was twofold. He claimed Jacob did not observe the proper formalities for leaving the employ of such an important man as Laban, and he accused Jacob of stealing. The accusations begin in verse 26. He says, "You've deceived me, carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword." In other words, you kidnapped my daughters. I'm glad we have verses 14 through 16, because there we learn that Leah and Rachel despise their father more than they despise each other, and that's saying something if you remember the baby wars lesson. They despise them. Okay, this is a raise your hand moment. How many of you believe Laban would have thrown a party and sent Jacob away with mirth and celebration? Raise your hand. Okay, let's try this. How many believe Laban's greatest concern is that he didn't get to kiss his daughters goodbye? No hands. The only truthful word from Laban's lips are found in verse 29. It's in my power to hurt you. And that's probably true. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, warning me to do you no harm. Notice he doesn't say, my God spoke to me. He said, the God of your fathers spoke to me. Laban's reason for saying he was able to harm Jacob was to intimidate him. But then he made a fatal error. He mentioned the dream. Should have kept his mouth shut. Because this emboldened Jacob, because it provided tangible proof God was keeping his promise he had made to Jacob at Bethel. Verse 30. Everything Laban has said so far is an attempt to disorient Jacob. Laban is trying, he's portraying himself, Laban, as the injured party, the victim. Then with the timing of a con man, Laban throws the curveball, because out of nowhere he says, so why did you steal my gods? Well, several cats jump out of the bag at this point. We learn Laban is an idolater. And we learn Laban's not there to express his heartbreak at the loss of his daughters. He came to accuse Jacob and catch him in an offense so he can continue to take advantage of him. Now, I want you to think back to verse 19. It was Rachel who took the gods. Jacob is certain he and his family are innocent of all charges. So, heartened by the mention of Laban's dream, he launches into his own counterattack against Laban. He says, let the person who has taken your gods die, and let our brethren judge among us who is guilty and who is innocent. It's evident Jacob doesn't know Rachel is the thief, because in a clear act of speaking first and thinking later, he pronounces a death sentence on his wife, not realizing she's guilty. So with verse 33, Laban begins his search, and he starts with his prime suspect, Jacob. Remember, Laban views Jacob as a thief who's gained his wealth by stealing Laban's flocks. Later in verse 43, Laban is going to claim, these are my daughters, in the sense that he believes he owns them. These are my grandchildren. These are my flocks, implication being which you stole. In fact, everything you can see is mine. If Laban believes this, and I think greed has distorted his thinking so much that he does, then it's no wonder he incorrectly believes Jacob is the thief. When the search of Jacob's tent fails to turn up any stolen property, he turns to Leah's tent. He probably thinks she's covering for Jacob, her husband. But this turns up nothing. Then he searches Bilhah's tent and then Zilpah's tent, where he also finds nothing. He finally enters Rachel's tent, and if the search occurred in the order of Laban's suspicions, then she is the lowest of his suspects. She's at the bottom of the totem pole, so to speak, and yet she's the guilty one. Why did she steal the idols? There's really not a clear answer to that question. Is it possible she was involved to some extent in idol worship? That's possible. We know Terah, Laban's ancestor, was involved with idols. And maybe the practice was never fully eradicated from the religion of the clan that remained in Syria. The Hebrew term used in verse 35 that's translated household idols is the word teraphim. It occurs 15 times in the Old Testament. It really refers to some small little idol statues. It's tempting to look for an explanation here that exonerates Rachel from idolatry. In fact, I'm not going to mention it now because I don't have time, but in your handout I put a little short paragraph on some archaeological discoveries that may exonerate her, and I think they probably do, actually. The idols had something to do with inheritance. Luke.
There wasn't any prohibition against idolatry at this time, was there? There wasn't any.
Well, the Mosaic Law did. The Ten Commandments had not been, obviously, had not been written. But I would be shocked if in the relationships between believers and God throughout the history here was not pretty clear about who God was and who he's not. But as far as the commandment, I think which what you're referring to, that's correct. So, I think it's interesting that these gods are not seeking. This is really what I want to focus on. It's interesting, these gods are not seeking their rightful owner, are they? They're not making themselves known in any way. Rather, Laban, like a blind man, is groping around looking for them. And I want you to think of this in contrast. These inanimate objects are doing nothing. But the true God came into the world to seek and to save those who are lost. The contrast is between nothing and a God who seeks and saves his people. Never forget, it's the good shepherd who seeks the lost sheep, not the other way around. This is section 3, Jacob's rebuttal of Laban. The important thing to remember up till now is that sometimes God changes our circumstances when he wants to change the direction of our lives, beginning with verse 36. Then Jacob became angry, and he contended with Laban, and Jacob said to Laban, "What's my transgression? What is my sin that you've hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here. Bring it out. Show it to the kinsmen, yours and mine, that they may decide between you and me. These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flocks. That which was torn of beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. Thus I was by day in the heat, consumed me, and frost by night, so that my sleep fled my eyes. These 20 years I've been in your house. I've served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment in my favor last night," and he's referring here to the dream. Jacob's rebuttal of Laban is recorded in verses 36 and following. The 20 years of frustration kept Jacob himself, I'm sure he kept this internalized, but it's now beginning to flow out like a flood. Not only has he endured two decades of frustration, but he's just been subjected to humiliation of being tracked like a criminal and searched by this man in the sight of whom must have made his skin crawl by this time. Laban, by his own admission, benefited greatly from Jacob's services. And had Jacob been treated fairly by Laban, there is no reason on the planet both men could not have prospered. It's not a given that Jacob could prosper only if Laban became poor. Sheep have lambs. Goats have kids, and by good shepherding, wealth is created. One of the myths of socialism is that there is a set amount of wealth in the world such that one party cannot win without another party losing. That is absolutely untrue. And if it's not true on a human plane, why would we assume God, who created the world and all the wealth in it, could not have blessed both Jacob and Laban? Jesus did a pretty good job when he fed the 5,000. There's no question this is true. And it's only by trying to hold on to his wealth with his greedy hands that Laban lost it. Laban didn't treat Jacob fairly from the beginning. He manipulated him. He used him. And through Jacob and this manipulation, Laban became rich. So in verse 36, Jacob asks, what's my transgression? What is my sin? Verse 37, he points out, you searched through all my possessions, you found nothing. And granted, because partly of Rachel's deception. Not only did he not find the household gods, but he found nothing in Jacob's possession that belonged to Laban. Jacob's statement also contains a legal challenge. He says, set what you found, which of course is nothing, before the court, so a judgment can be made. Laban's inability to produce evidence is a vindication of Jacob's innocence. Jacob continues. In verse 38, Jacob claims he served Laban faithfully for 20 years, that he did a good job, and he did not take advantage of his employer. Now, in the ancient Near East, shepherds were allowed on occasion to select a mature ram from the flock to eat. Not all at once, but I think you get the point. You have a little party. In 20 years, Jacob had not taken a ram for himself. Furthermore, under his care, the ewes rarely miscarried. Beyond these things, according to traditional ancient Near Eastern law, a shepherd was not held responsible for any losses incurred from the attacks by wild animals or for losses from theft, particularly if they occurred at night. This, we find this legal language in the Code of Hammurabi. It's also in Exodus chapter 21, verse 12, and in Exodus 22, verses 9 through 11. But in the case of Jacob, he suffered all these losses himself, and Laban suffered nothing. Verse 40 summarizes Jacob's life with Laban. It accurately portrays the variation between the scorching heat in the day, the freezing cold at night, that are characteristics of Syria. Jacob's days were hot. His nights were cold so much that he couldn't sleep. The years he labored for what he thought was Rachel, years that seemed like but days, are long behind him. Once the true character of Laban was made evident on Jacob's wedding night, the discomforts he experienced working for him began to grow. While Jacob worked under the worst of conditions, Laban prospered. Back in verse 7, when Jacob was discussing his situation with Leah and Rachel, he made the claim that Laban had changed his wages 10 times. And then here in verse 41, he makes the claim to Laban's face. Laban doesn't deny it. Jacob and Laban both knew Laban had manipulated the fine print of their contract for his own benefit, and there was no more need for a charade. Jacob gets to the heart of the matter in verse 42. If God had not intervened, there would have been no parties, there would have been no music, no goodbye kisses. In fact, he says, you would have sent me away with nothing. Jacob is calling Laban a liar, and that's what he is. He refers in his attack to the God of Abraham, that is the God Laban rejected, the fear of Isaac, that is the God Isaac feared and revered, the very God whom you do not know rebuked you last night, and he's the reason that you've done no harm to me. The verdict was rendered not by a jury, but by the ultimate judge, God himself, and the judgment was rendered after the unsuccessful search of the tents the previous night. So what can Laban say to this? He knows Jacob's speaking the truth. So what does he do? Well, as a good con man, he backtracks, and he suggests that they establish a covenant. And this is the fourth section of the chapter, and I promise I will go quickly through this. Verse 43, then Laban replied to Jacob. Then Laban replied to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters and to their children whom they've borne? So now let's make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. And Jacob took a stone and he set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather the stones. So they took stones, they made a heap or a pile, and they ate there before the heap. Now Laban, the Syrian, called this Yagar Sahadutha, which is Aramaic. Jacob called it Galid, which is Hebrew. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore it was named Galid. and Mitzpah, for he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man will see it, God is witness between you and me. Laban said to Jacob, behold this heap and behold this pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass by this heap to do harm to you, and you will not pass by this heap to do, or this pillar to do harm to me. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal. They ate the meal and they spent the night on the mountains. Early in the morning, Laban arose, kissed his sons and kissed his daughters, blessed them, and then Laban departed and returned to his place. This marks the treaty and final separation of these families. Throughout Laban's association with Jacob, he never saw matters from Jacob's point of view. I'm not sure he was capable of doing that. When he made the claim Leah and Rachel and the children were his, he believed it. When he said the flocks of Jacob are his, he believed it. And when he said everything you see here is mine, Laban believed it. Jacob was a non-person to Laban. Following Jacob's rebuttal, Laban offered no defense because Laban's worldview was based on fantasy and not on reality. He was the grand manipulator, but he ran out of words when confronted by the truth. Yet Laban still saw Jacob as the threat, and this is the reason he proposed the covenant. It was to protect the pursuer from the pursued. Laban continued to make decisions from a distorted view of reality. So, and this is the last point, really. We have here a line of separation. This has been coming since Jacob left Syria. We know that God has called believers of all eras to be separate from the world. But sometimes we may wonder how and where to draw that line. Yet it's the world that will separate itself from us when our lives are committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to sound theology. You can be religious and find acceptance in the world. In fact, the world will, for the most part, respect you. What infuriates the world is not religion, but the gospel. Apart from the work of the Holy Spirit, the cross is foolishness to the world. Any mention of eternal perdition that awaits those who are not saved by the blood of Jesus Christ will bring about separation from the world. Christian exclusivism, by which I mean personal salvation is through Christ and Christ alone, will result in separation from the world. Certainly you'll want to avoid any mention of divine election if you want to be accepted by the world, and stay clear of the biblical position on marriage and sexuality if you want to be accepted by the world. So when Laban is confronted by Jacob's accusation, you've been rebuked by the one true God, Laban decides to set the boundary that will serve as a dividing line between him and Jacob and between his pagan idolatry and the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob, the believer, didn't set the boundary of separation. Laban, the unbeliever, did because he wanted nothing more to do with Jacob. Verse 47 continues this theme of separation. They named this pile of stone by an Aramaic name and by a Hebrew name. And I think the use of those two languages also point to separation. The third name, this mitzvah, simply means watchtower. In a state of continual delusion, Laban cites the need for God to watch over Laban's daughters, lest Jacob mistreat them. So this monument is established, it's blessed, it's sanctified by sacrifice. Laban kisses his children, that's why he says he came there in the first place, and he left. So this chapter in Jacob's life, which is a long chapter, ends, and a new one begins. God has kept his word, he will continue to keep his word, but there are trials and adventures ahead for the namesake of God's chosen people, and I apologize for going over, but my 12 pages of notes began as 18 pages. This was a process of elimination. Jeff, you want to close us in prayer?
Father, again, we are awed by your providence and your grace in the midst of using flaws.